If you really want to understand the MCAT, go check out the MCAT Cars Strategy Course from Jack Wesson. The MCAT is based on critical thinking. The whole test is based on reading. Learn step by step how to read and answer questions. Learn the skills necessary to understand the test. Become objective in your test taking. Learn the patterns and finish the sections on time. Go check out the MCAT Cars Strategy Course at jackwesson.com today. The MCAT Cars Podcast, session number 82. The car section of the MCAT gives thousands of pre-meds nightmares every night. Whether you're an ESL student, lack confidence while reading, or a slow reader like me, Jack Wesson and the medical school headquarters are here to help you score higher in every section so you can be confident you're ready to get the MCAT score of your dreams. Welcome to the MCAT Cars Podcast. My name is Dr. Ryan Gray, your host here every week. And I'm excited to bring you another amazing episode of the MCAT Cars Podcast. Now, I want to ask for a favor. If you've been listening to this podcast, if you've gotten help from this podcast, if your scores have improved because of this podcast, I would love for you to share this podcast with an advisor, with a friend, with anyone who you think would benefit from this as well. You can share it anywhere. Just send them to MCATCarsPodcast.com and we will do the rest. Let's go ahead and say hello to Jack Wesson. Jack Wesson, back for some more MCAT Cars Podcast. How are you today?
I'm good, Ryan. How's it going?
It is going very well. I tried to make some neural networks look dumb myself over the last week. So if you see me arrested for anything, I wasn't hacking, I promise.
That's okay. I got you.
You got me. You got my back. Like, sorry, Judge. He was just practicing what he was learning. What's going on today for our passage?
So, I mean, unlike last week's, this is going to be longer, and it's not going to be as interesting. So, it's just trying to figure out how to deal with those longer, more mundane passages.
Okay, and just kind of general sense. I know you've said it a few times. Typically, if a student flips to the next passage and they see a short passage, a lot of times they go, yes, short, that's easy. But you've stated a few times that the shorter the passage, usually the harder the questions.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, usually the lengths are around the same. Okay. So it's more about the difficulty of the text rather than the length.
Okay.
So if the text is harder to read, the questions are typically easier. Mm. They're going to ask you more general questions like, what's the main idea? If the text is harder to read, easier to read, so it's easier, it's typically a little bit longer, not significantly.
Okay.
Like, it's not by much, but it's enough to where you have to really be careful and you have to really assess where things are discussed. Location becomes more critical because the questions become more specific. So I find that the questions are harder because you need to be very careful with what they said to a T. You know, like, you have to really pay attention. With the harder passages, you still want to pay attention. Like, we're going to look at a harder one today, but it's getting the point. The point is more important than getting every little detail. Okay. So, they don't test you on the details, but they test you on smaller points of views that are kind of hidden in the passage.
Got it. All right. Again, if you want to follow along, go to the show notes, or if you're listening on a device, just swipe over, click on the little artwork, and you can see the passage there. First paragraph. Without the modern scourge of light pollution, the ancient Greeks and Romans saw more of the heavens than we normally do, and they made stargazing a more central aspect of their culture. All right, so Greeks and Romans, so we're going to be talking maybe about a lot of stuff from the past, and it's the author is starting off talking about light pollution, which I know what light pollution is, but I think a lot of people might be confused as to what light pollution is. But it's saying that this light pollution, or the lack of light pollution, rather, helped the Greeks and Romans see more of the heavens, see more of the stars.
Yeah. And what do you think light pollution actually does?
So I know what light pollution is. Light pollution is with our cities and having street lights and house lights and everything on, it lightens up the sky. It makes it harder to see the stars.
Yeah, exactly. So you can assume that based on what you're reading it, because it says without the modern light pollution, these ancients could stargaze, right? Mm-hmm. They can see the stars. So with it, you probably can't see the stars as well. That's something that any reader, especially, you know, a future MCAT test taker, should be able to deduce based on just one sentence. That's why I always say these sentences educate you. You have to read it carefully, because if you do, you can start making those key assumptions. Now, I don't want you to go overboard. You don't need to go too far into this, but there are some common sense points of views that you can pick up on this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
From this. Yeah.
Awesome. Following the number-loving philosopher Pythagoras, Cicero wrote that the intervals of a musical scale echo the intervals between the orbits of our solar system. All right, so we have Pythagoras, I'm assuming the number-loving person, the founder of the Pythagorean theorem probably, and Cicero, they're talking about just the stars and how it affects our lives with music and everything else.
Okay, good. This goes back to the first sentence, because the first sentence said that they could stargaze more, right, without light pollution. But the whole mm-hmm. point of that sentence was not that. Wasn't that, oh, they can stargaze more because they lack pollution, light mm-hmm. pollution, right, lights. But it's because when you stargaze, it became a more central aspect of their culture. So they kind of connected culture with stargazing. So you can't lose sight of the point of that sentence, because that is actually going to help you understand the next sentence, right? The second sentence you just read, that sentence is talking about what? Stargazing, in mm-hmm. this case, solar system, and our culture, music.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's kind of connecting the two. Intervals of music, so our culture, between the orbits of our solar system. So you don't need to really get this. It's more of an example, more of evidence for that concept that you can, you know, just because you can, you know, you can see the lights, you end up using it, or the stars, excuse me, because of the lack of lights, you use it more in your culture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
Ooh, all right. The Stoics, believers in an independent cosmos, look to the night sky to augur our predestined lives. All right, so we were introduced to a lot of people here. So we have the Greeks, the Romans, Pythagoras, Cicero, and now the Stoics. And it tells us who the Stoics are, that they are believers in an independent cosmos. And they looked, I don't know what augur means off the top of my head, but they seems like they believed in destiny, like predestined lives.
Yeah, you don't need to know what it means, but you could probably guess it has something to do with stars and our lives. Again, culture and the stars. So it's still similar, still going along the same lines.
Mm-hmm.
Augur most likely means prediction. You're okay. Predicting something about our, you know, our destiny. Okay.
Yeah. Of particular interest to all these ancients was the Stella Erratica, or errant star, so called for its shifting location. Ooh, they had UFOs back then. So they had this definition of a star that seemed to shift locations, the Stella Erratica.
Okay. So just still talking about stars, mm-hmm. nothing new here. Go ahead.
Our familiar constellations, by contrast, remain fixed in the firmament. I have no idea what firmament means, but I think it's saying, right, modern times, our familiar constellations are fixed. We don't have shifting locations.
Okay, good. So there is a kind of a disconnect, right? Something, these stars, these errant stars, are shifting locations, whereas our familiar constellations, and it says by contrast, those are fixed.
Mm.
Okay, and firmament just means the heavens, the sky. Okay, go ahead.
Romans borrowed a word from the Greeks to denote these celestial strays, planeta or planet. Ooh, okay. So the errant star that was shifting location was just a planet moving in its orbit.
Well, no, be careful.
Maybe
be
the careful. Romans were calling that. We don't know okay. if it was a planet. So the Romans called it a planet.
Okay, sounds good.
Does that make sense? Is that okay. better?
Yeah, well, the key here is to realize that there's something that's fixed, right? And and there's something that's shifting locations. And yeah, so basically something's going on where we're kind of creating this new term, right, to explain this phenomena.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
All right. Paragraph 2. Derived from the verb to wander, the original Greek noun, and I have no idea because it's in Greek letters, was applied to more than just Mars and Saturn. In Euphrates Baccha, to take just one example, it refers to a vagabond who comes to town. Euripides is that name. Okay, so lots of really big words here, an actual word I can't pronounce because it's written in Greek, but it's, they give us the word to wander. So I'm going to hold on to that as kind of the key takeaway for this sentence is something is coming from wandering and moving, right?
What was the word right before, Ryan? Sorry to interrupt. What was that word right before?
To wander, a verb?
No. The previous paragraph.
Planet.
Okay. So we're still discussing the planet.
Yep.
So derived from the word to wander. So planet is derived from the word to wander. Okay?
Got it. All right.
Now, yeah, you get this Greek, whatever. I don't even know it's Greek, right? but was applied to more than just Mars and Saturn, of course, our planets. And then, you know, you have this guy, Euripides, who referred to it as vagabond. That's besides the point. What you should know are that planets are wandering, right? Mm-hmm. They're moving around. Of course, we know they're not actually stars, but that's how they interpreted them back in the day. Okay?
Okay. Among the physicians of the ancient world, including Hippocrates himself, another Greek word, could also mean fever, a pestilence that migrates from person to person. All right, so now we're switching from talking about planets to talking about physicians and a fever using this same word. So it's the same word here in Greek, to wander. And talking about a fever going from person to person.
Yeah, so it's weird. We went from talking about moving stars or planets as planets, and now we're calling them fevers, right? Planets are also considered fevers, mm-hmm. Okay? So again, we're still on the idea of planet. The word planet, the definition is simply changing a little bit, right? We went from talking about it as to wander, to vagabond, which we don't really need to know, to now fever. So planet has all of these different meanings in this case.
Okay. All right. Very interesting. The Romans, of course, had their own words for disease, morbus, pestis, but they adopted the astronomical language in their own medical writings too, using the Latin cognate. All right. So we have now bringing the Romans into this, talking about how they're bringing some of the language, the astronomical language in to medicine.
Okay, sounds good. So again, planet is used in these different ways. Go ahead.
In one account, planeta refers to a fever with an unrestrained onset. Okay, so giving us a specific example here of that planeta, the errant star that the Romans called planeta, an unrestrained onset. Not really sure what that means, but we'll go with it.
Yeah, just basically randomly coming about, right? It just happens randomly. Okay. Yeah.
In another, planete are those illnesses that obey neither finite duration nor predictable prognosis. So again, this erratic, this errant disease. It's not obeying all the normal rules that they see with illness.
that's the point that you just have to pick up. That's it. So what do we share with the word planet? The idea that it's random, right? It's errant, it's erratic, mm-hmm. right? So the planets are shifting locations, right? But so are these fevers, right? Whatever they are, they're random. They're shifting locations. So it seems like it makes sense to use the word planet to describe both of them.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, very cool. All right. I can't even like fathom a time where we didn't know like specifically the orbits of the planets and, specifically like the germs and viruses and bacteria that cause disease. It's so interesting to live in that time.
Right. And 1,000 years from now, they're going to think of us in that way.
Exactly.
Wow. I can't believe we didn't think about the universe in this way or that way. Right.
They had to draw your blood to see what was in it. That is so archaic. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Next paragraph. According to the Lexicographical History of Planeta, the Fordham's Matthew McGowan catalogs in the Thesaurus Lingae Latinae, the same ancient word means both a celestial body and a mundane affliction. All right, now we're getting into the actual like strict definitions of what this planeta means from looks like maybe a professor or somebody at Fordham, which is a university. I guess you would have to know that. And I don't know if this is a book. I'm assuming this is maybe a book that he wrote, but anyway, so
it is, yeah. It's in italics, so it's probably a mm-hmm. essay or a book or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And basically, this guy, the expert Matthew McGowan, says that planeta was used for two different things: celestial body and mundane affliction.
Sounds good.
But with some creative reflection, this paradoxical pairing starts to make a little sense. All right, so creative reflection, thinking, I guess, paradoxical pairing. So maybe paradoxical to me is like they normally potentially wouldn't make sense together, paradoxical pairing. And he's saying that it does make a little bit of a sense when you think about it.
What was that paradoxical pairing? What
was that? Celestial body and mundane affliction.
Yeah, and that was the whole fever and the planets, right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Both the errant star and the roving illness shatter our attempts at a tidy ordering of the natural world around us and within us. All right, so the author here stating, right, we want order, maybe, right? Our attempts at a tidy ordering, and we have this planeta that's moving around, this errant star, and these affliction, this fever that's not obeying what we normally see.
Yeah, and that's exactly what you predicted, right? Earlier in the last paragraph. Okay.
Okay. Planets and plagues appear to move according to their own plans, not ours. Kind of timely with recording this during a pandemic. Okay, so planets and plagues moving according to their own plans, right? Not to the tidy ordering that we want.
Cool way of understanding, you know, how these things came about. Okay, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Next paragraph. This Greco-Roman metaphor hints at the unpredictability we grapple with daily while the coronavirus pandemic continues to elude containment. Oh, it is an article about the pandemic. All right. So definitely, right? This author using this story of where planet comes from, the word planet, and just saying it's kind of interesting how it's just unpredictable, right?
Right, and it's kind of tied to the pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yep. In the absence of adequate laboratory testing, our methods of diagnosing COVID-19 sometimes remain at the level of errant guesswork. Speaking for myself, I now head to the kitchen periodically to sniff aromatic tomatoes and hot sauce to check my sense of smell, hardly the pinnacle of scientific precision. All right, so the author here writing about just how we don't have adequate laboratory testing and how diagnosing this COVID-19 is potentially to the level of just guessing. And he's using one of the symptoms that has come up, this anosmia, I think. I don't have the word in front of me, so forgive me if I'm mispronouncing it, but the lack of smell. He's going and smelling stuff just to make sure he still has it.
See, if you read this, like, let's say 20 years from now, would you have caught the fact that smelling is a diagnosis, is a way to diagnose yourself or be able to figure out if you have the disease?
It depends on if COVID-19 is big in 20 years. But no, probably not, right? It's in the top of our mind now because it's active.
Right. And, you know, if you've been watching the news, you know that, you know, you lose your sense of smell for not everyone, but some people who get COVID lose their sense of smell. So this is the way the author's trying to explain it, right? By suggesting that we don't know how to diagnose it. It's unpredictable to the point that I have to now smell tomatoes to see if I can even smell anymore, right? To make sure I don't have this disease.
Yes.
So the way you could catch that without actually knowing it is, again, being educated by noticing it says the methods of diagnosing COVID, right? So this is probably one way you can diagnose yourself, which I don't recommend. I think you should go to a doctor if you have any kind of symptoms. But, you know, in this case, this is how the author described it. So don't get lost in this fluff, right? Is this important for the bigger picture? No. The point this paragraph is trying to make is that whether it's a planet or a disease like the pandemic we're going through, it's unpredictable, right? So don't get lost in this factoid about how, you know, you diagnose yourself through smelling, right? That's besides the point. That's like an additional kind of nice cushion for the point they really care about, which is it's all unpredictable.
Yeah. All right. Next sentence. And as billions of people are now learning through strict restrictions on movement, it is mankind that needs to fix itself into immobile constellations when the natural world decides to break out of its familiar orbit. Oh, this is deep. This author's good. All right, so the author now talking about our kind of shelter in place, states, safer at home rules, where we just have to stay put so we don't catch this COVID-19.
Right. Very ironic, right? Mm-hmm. So we're studying all this stuff. Now we're immobile. Yep. But again, this is a point you wouldn't catch if you're not from this era.
Yeah.
And a lot of the articles that you're going to read are boring because you're not going to catch the nuances of the conversation. That's why it's boring to you. That's why you don't care for it. That's why it's disconnected from you. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. That's what we're supposed to do. We're in some ways time travelers when we read these really long, mundane passages, because we have to start sensing where the author is going, what the author is trying to say, without necessarily getting lost in the minutiae and the things that don't really make a difference to us at the end of the day.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Next paragraph. While we might find the ancient coupling of planets and pestilence jarring, our language has its own startling metaphorical bedfellows. All right. I have no idea what bedfellows means, but the author basically saying that maybe for us to think about these ancient words isn't that helpful, but the author is going to tell us that we have our own language that might explain some of this.
Yeah, it's, again, probably showing us how this could happen to our own kind of language, right? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the Greek or Latin one, but from our own perspective. We'll see if there's any similarity here. Okay. But yeah, bedfellows just means bedmates. So, you know, similar kind of together.
Awesome.
Okay.
Our word virus is a rich example. So jumping right into what our language is. So virus is an example, and we'll hopefully find out what that means. In ancient Latin texts, a virus is some kind of biological fluid. In Pliny the Elder, it means semen on one page and venom on another. All right, so talking about Latin here, where a lot of our language comes from, the word virus is referred to as just a biological fluid, not specifically how we use virus now, and gives two different examples of what virus means in this one book.
Okay.
Taking up these Roman anecdotes, the English virus, as the Oxford English Dictionary reports, originally points to such substances, including venom, but also pus and other humors. All right, so again, the Romans now are talking about what virus meant to them in this old Oxford English Dictionary.
Okay.
Only in the first years of the 20th century does the modern notion of a, quote, virus emerge, that of a tiny pathogen that invades the living cells of another of other organisms. All right, so we have the first years of the 20th century, which is when we could actually start thinking about viruses and seeing viruses eventually.
Okay, so what's the point of this paragraph?
I have no idea, other than it tells me the origin of the word virus and how it was different than now.
Yeah, I mean, that's really it. Virus had different meanings. Now it's changing, right? And that's etymology for you, right? Mm-hmm. Words have different meanings over time. We have words today that don't make any sense if you actually think about it. Okay, go ahead.
All right. Of course, the linguistic transfer from semen to pus to pathogen aligns with the technological developments that enabled scientists to observe something like a coronavirus in the first place. All right, so the author just pointing out that our language was shaped when we could actually see this thing.
By what? By what means?
Technological developments.
That's it. So our technology is in some ways changing the word.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A 1915 issue of The Lancet hypothesizes that it, quote, is quite possible that an ultra-microscopic virus belongs among other known disease-causing agents like bacteria, which are significantly larger. All right, so 1915 is when they first apparently started hypothesizing this, of what a virus is, without seeing it.
Okay, again, kind of evidence for that technology, right? That's shifting the definition or the meaning of a virus.
Mm-hmm. As photographs in today's newspapers confirm with the help of advanced microscopes, that earlier hypothesis has borne out, replacing the image of snake venom with one of geometric capsids. All right, so the snake venom, going back to the ancient Latin definition of what a virus is to now that of these geometric capsids, these viruses, and what they look like.
Sounds good. This last couple parts of the passage are really random,
yeah,
but in some ways they're similar because it's showing us how the words evolve, right? So there isn't much to be gained in that last couple of paragraphs. I think the biggest parts that you have to know is the fact that, you know, you can use, you know, celestial kind of cosmology and medical terminology in the same way, right? They intersect in some ways. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the point the author is trying to make. But don't get lost if the last couple paragraphs shift and start talking about something totally else, different. I mean, that could happen and it does happen. But typically, if the MCAT does this, they won't make it more than a paragraph long where they deviate off course.
Do you feel like the AAMC, the test writers, are potentially finding articles that do that on purpose to make sure that you're tracking along and following along and have increased kind of contextual awareness with everything? Like the shifting of the context of what's being written about?
I think that they're trying to make points from each article. They want to make sure you get those points. I don't think they're purposefully doing that. No. I just think that when they pick out these articles, they're picking it out in a way where there's at least 4 or 5 different points that you need to know. And they could make it longer by adding extra paragraphs that aren't necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, they're finding it all from one source. So it's basically like cutting a snap. It's like a snapshot of a movie, right? Or they're making a cut off of a book or an article. And that's kind of what we're doing here, right? We cut off the articles to the points that we really care about. And when they do that, sure, there's some lingering ideas or paragraphs that don't really matter. So they realize that's there, but they don't. I don't think they're doing it on purpose. I think they have to do it to meet some kind of length requirement.
All right, so there you have it. Another great one for you. A little bit harder this time. Some confusing stuff in there, but we made it through. I hope you made it through. And more importantly, I hope you learned. Learning is the name of the game when it comes to the MCAT. Understanding how to take these tests. That is the name of the game. So hopefully that was helpful for you. Again, go to jackweston.com. Sign up for his free trial sessions that he has almost every week. Again, jackweston.com. We'll see you next time here on the MCAT Cars Podcast.
This is MedEd Media.